system. I find you in the shows and moving are great. And being a nerd, the sign system is everywhere you go.
Hello to our 1,100,000 listeners. That was a good one. Yeah, Happy New Year. This episode is a greatest hits of our first 20 episodes. And we pick our brains and repick our brains by getting these snippets from various episodes, such as our design technologist episode with PJ's friend Aisha. Our episode about releases, we touch back on mandates, how Figma is not a design system, ding, ding, ding. And then go back, talk a little bit about ROI, hindsight, feedback, and contributions. I think that was the last, one of the later ones. The most exciting thing, I think, just to go back to why we started this thing, was we wanted an outlet for us to have weekly conversations with each other about design systems. And I knew when we had started, it would be interesting because we have somewhat similar points of view, but sometimes there's divergent points of view in terms of where we like to focus our energy, what our companies are doing, what we're working on. And it was a great time for us just to capture that. And this episode is the 28th one we've recorded, no matter what order. And that's pretty mind-boggling. And we haven't had a design tokens episode. And we're on episode 28. Without further ado, let's get into the greatest hits. Episode 9, return on investment, ROI.
Okay, but how much is a design system going to help you or going to help us in these situations? And is the value of the design system worth the investment that you're asking for? Or is it still more cost effective just to deal with that pain when it comes? And that's always been the challenge from my perspective, is how you objectively show that it's worth investing the money in systems as opposed to somewhere else.
Yeah, I love that red example, or the button example, because that was one of my first forays into design systems. Was at Goodreads, we were looking to, at that point, we called it, you know, a visual style guide, right? So we were looking to build a visual style guide, and we were looking to refactor a button and make it a React button that worked across web and mobile web. So that audit illustrated that we had dozens of different, you know, primary beige colors. We had different colors that represented the parts of the gradient. At that time, the button was a gradient button. And the thought experiment was, what would it take to update this button to a solid color? So let's say that we wanted it to be like a solid, you know, brown color. How many instances of this button exist in the code? And it was, I would say a little bit alarming. And the longer, obviously, the more mature of a product that you have and you stood up, and as you come across buttons that you may have, engineers may have designed, 5 years ago, this number could be dozens. Like, dozens of these instances could occur. And a button, I think, is a good example because it's a foundational component that could be refactored. Obviously, there's upfront costs and with a lot of the stuff with auditing what you have, looking into the code base, working with engineering on that, and trying to figure out how to build this component to be flexible, across breakpoints, and then you're done with it, and then it's a clean slate that you could kind of build upon, and then as you a nod to our previous episode, multi-brand design systems. If you needed to support an additional brand or maybe like a business design system, you could use this foundational component to riff off from there.
You know, the interesting thing for me when trying to tell us, like try to make the case for return on investment, is that up to this point, if your system's relatively new, if you don't have a lot of adoption, it ultimately there is going to be a bit of a leap of faith, like a blind leap that you're the case that you're making, because you don't have those numbers in place. And so you have to try to connect the dots, and you have to guess, make educated guesses. Typically what I've done in the past is I've talked with engineers, I've talked with designers, I've tried to get like a heuristic sense of how much time we think we can save, based off of their direct experience, and then try to extract that out across an organization and hope to God that the numbers pan out in terms of return on investment. But even that is still fuzzy. It's fuzzy math. And that's the challenge that I've run up against. It sounds like that wasn't as much of an issue at Disney Streaming during your tenure.
I think there was a very easy upfront investment onto like the lowercase design system early on. So there was very good buy-in to build off of these foundational components. Whether our 7 client engineering teams had done coded components that match that, I think that's a different story, but it laid the foundation for this, V1, lowercase design system. The harder part about this, I think for us was like, much like I think many other product teams, you try to shoehorn what you can when you see project opportunities pop up. So Star Plus, for example, we knew was going to be an opportunity to roll out design tokens and, this multi-theme approach. So we took a step back and worked on this foundational layer upfront, and, that ended up working out in our favor, because we were able to establish that need.
Episode 10, hindsight, what we wish we'd known.
Not only that, but let's say you have a type ramp of like 30 sizes, which is a lot. If you put yourself in the place of a product designer that has to look at that and try to figure out how to use it, when do I use the 25th sized typeface for type size versus 26? Like, there's a lot of area for ambiguity and complexity, and like, I have no idea how to use this right. The simpler you make it, theoretically at least, the easier you understand. Everything has its use, very clear, hopefully, or clearer at least, and just easier to wrap your head around. I do remember this one system I worked on had a type ramp of 4 sizes, had 8 colors, and because we had the luxury of it was focused on tooling, where we didn't need a lot of visual flair, and it was really easy to understand how to use each size and each color, because there wasn't a lot to choose from. Some people understandably don't like that because it doesn't give them a lot of options. I tend to really like it because it's a constraint. You try to think creatively around that constraint and focus on other stuff. But I think that is typically a controversial topic, divisive maybe among designers.
Yeah, that's such an interesting concept. Just thinking about using 5 or, as a number, like maybe to start with 5 type sizes, 5 brand colors, absent of utility colors, 5 units of measure. So 4 times whatever. It does greatly simplify things. And it does remind me of designing a bit for Roku devices, which in terms of like hard drive space is fairly minimal. So they do require us to think about a minimal amount of font faces, preferably 1 to 2. And in the case that we had tried to, use 1, they're really looking at using as few font sizes as possible, no weight changes. If we're thinking about this from like a constraint-based model and adding guardrails, it does help you really, if you're able to start from that in a very clean slate, I think you'd be able to think about these sort of additions more meaningfully, intentionally.
Yeah, it's. I think that is a topic in and of itself. The exponentiality of design systems, which would be a fun topic to cover down the road, because you can get in really deep of how much complexity you inject by just adding 5 colors to your color palette. Just that can start to really grow the amount of combinations that you can see, color combinations you can see within the product really quickly. Kind of staggering, actually, if you dig into it. So that might be a fun topic for another week.
Yeah, that'd be a good one. Yeah. One of the other things that I would think back that would have helped get even better adoption is better documentation, whether that's in on a reference site or just inside the tool itself. I think we could do a lot of goodwill by just documenting usage patterns alongside some of this stuff. So like if you're in a Figma frame, having a frame next to it just talking about like how this thing may be compiled, maybe even show if you do have code generated components, reference components that these are like, you know, related to, and then really talk about the anatomy of how something is built, explaining how something is built and how components are compiled to be, you know, molecules, for instance, I think really showcases the flexibility of a lot of the work that we do. Even I noticed when we've explained some of like the theming exercises that we've done from one app to another app, and showcasing that, you know, with this unified token layer, if we keep the token names the same, the semantic token names, you'd be able to do now with the technology, just library swaps that could just swap from one theme to another. So that was one thing, you know, 3 years ago, did not exist in the apps themselves, like the library swapping, but that's been extremely helpful to showcase the power of a lot of this stuff.
Episode 13, feedback.
Had a few run-ins, I would say, with surveys and of different flavors. So that's something that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about too. Previously at Disney Streaming, there's a few methods of surveys or types of surveys that we sent out, like ones that were more sentiment focused, just to understand very broad strokes. Originally, the first survey that my previous manager had sent out was really trying to understand very foundational, like, did we meet the needs, you know, for you to build XYZ thing for this year. Those, I think, were very good just to show demand and show interest in the system. And then as we've sent out the second, third, fourth survey, we've sort of evolved it. The second and third ones were more sentiment focused. Second and third ones also had near identical questions. So I was able to run them. We did them annually just to, for whatever reason, I think that was just a good cadence for us just to not get survey fatigue. But we were able to track that over time. The fourth survey that we sent out at Disney Streaming was a different one, not sentiment focused, but the SUS, like system usability scale, 10 questions, specific framework. Benefit of this one also is that it's doesn't take a lot of time to administer, doesn't take a lot of time to take, but also we're able to gather a score and then track that score over time. So that's something that at Meta I'm getting done for this half as well. And the reason why I wanted to move away from the sentiment survey was you do get mixed results. We're trying to understand specifically what the pain points were. Ironically enough, there's at the bottom of our survey, we just have like an open text box. And we found out in my instance now is that there's some gaps in our Figma component libraries. Very extremely achievable and very, very tactical feedback. So this half, my system usability survey is focused thematically on the component libraries. Last half, it was focused a little more broadly, but then there was a more of a tune towards support. So something else that we're thinking through is possibly running this system usability survey, but for different facets of the system. So we've done support, we've done component libraries. We'll probably do something like education as like another one.
Could you dig into what specific questions you ask for the usability survey?
They're extremely, if you Google, SUS survey, it's, I could go through some of them right now. So it's a list of 10 questions. And what we're really trying to gather is whether the capabilities meet your requirements, whether the system is a frustrating experience, whether the system is easy to use, Another question that I thought was very interesting in there is like whether you need guidance to use this thing, whether you need, if you are new, if you are a new person on the, you would not need much support to get up and running. So there's very specific pointed questions, and we're able to, there's like a score mechanism on there, and hopefully we sort of track the score and tick up. One thing that we're just looking to tick up is like, if it's a very tactical thing that we're trying to fix, say like, provide more coverage in the Figma libraries, hopefully, next half, when I run the survey again, then we'll see, an uptick, on that. Episode 18, contributions.
Okay. I'm going to start everything with saying that we are actively working on defining a contribution model. So everything I say after this should be put through the lens of that we're working on a contribution model. So I do believe in it. But with that being said, contribution models are, if handled incorrectly, in my opinion, can be a nightmare. Because as someone who's not working on a system, it is not your job to understand how all the pieces fit together. We don't want to burden folks with trying to getting in the weeds of like, well, you know, all these little pieces have to be taken into consideration. It's a lot of stuff. And so it feels really good to open up the doors and say, yeah, we want to have all these designs come in. That feels really good. And it is really good to be open. The easy part is making this stuff, getting stuff in. The tough part is maintaining it and who owns it. If we own it, how, you know, do we feel confident in the contribution? If someone else owns it, can they really own it? Are they going to, you know, our priorities going to shift and they're not going to have the bandwidth to maintain those things and support and answer all the questions and fix bugs and all the long tail of work. And so contributions are something that I believe in, but I'm also extremely cautious about because the devil's in the details. Once you spin that thing up, how do you make sure that you haven't just hitched a ride with like a wild bull? And that's what we're trying to figure out on the team. How do we set something up where there's clear expectations, where the model is sustainable, and that we have some level of confidence that a year from now, we're going to feel, we're not going to be wondering how we got here and how do we get the hell out? So that's my take, you know, at a surface level. I've done enough talking. Davey, what's your thoughts on a contribution model?
I'm going to make a PJ-like statement. Contribution models and contributions are expensive. That's a very PJ-like statement. And I'll tell you sort of two facets of how this has worked or maybe has not worked in the past. At Disney, we got really excited about contributions, and the product design teams and engineering teams working on Disney Plus, Hulu, Star Plus are very siloed. I guess that's the easiest way to say it. They're separate. They don't sit together. It's not a cross-functional team. It's more of a handoff sort of thing. So while there are cross-functional facets of it, a contribution there meant that designers would work with the design system team to create an update to a pattern that is meant to be extended. And we would work with them to then sit at the table with them and work with engineers on their behalf to make sure that this thing not only meets the design system quality, but is built the right way. So that's one facet. And it worked fairly well. It works very well when you have a design system team of, I would say, five or more, a product design team that you support that's maybe, I'm going to throw out a number, less than 30 designers. There's some ratio that I haven't quite figured out. Really worked out when you're able to work with designers one-on-one and jam with them and really not only listen to how you might extend a pattern beyond their specific use case, but how you could effectively bring in engineering to come jam with us as well.
Yeah.
Episode 20, education and onboarding.
Yeah, you mentioned something about ongoing education, which I love, and I'm very excited about learning about new processes and how other teams work within our company. But not everybody is as open to taking either courses or workshops when they feel that they've been there and, you know, been around the block a few times. So how have you sold trainings for people that have been with the company for, you know, over a year or two?
Oh, Davey, I haven't. Turns out just because I think something's a good idea doesn't necessarily mean that everyone thinks it's a good idea. Continuing education is not an uncommon thing in the world. My wife's a nurse. She has by far and away a more important job than I do. And she is expected to take continuing education because knowledge changes, processes changes, the science changes. And so what you know yesterday may not be relevant. It may actually be dangerous. And so our experience is a double-edged sword. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it injects huge amounts of bias into our work and is no longer relevant. So I think all of us, our team included, should have some level of continuing education to make sure that we're aware of best practices, of the evolving evidence, both externally and internally, as to how to build products to meet people's needs. We are lucky to have a rare talent in Cynthia Romero, who is amazing at outreach, community management, engagement, and education with not only the design team, but design and engineering. I would make the case that education is one of the most critical skills to have within a design org, to make sure that you're up-leveling everyone within the design org, and one of the rarest skills. We oftentimes evaluate talent based off of your ability to make pretty pictures and design beautiful things in Figma. What we tend to often undervalue is the ability to have a designer educate and up-level many designers and help them get on the same page and help them work better. It's hard to measure. It's hard to turn into an objective number. And so it oftentimes goes undervalued, underseen. And I see it every day. She does an amazing job. She has had a huge impact within our team, within our design org, and I'd argue within our company because of the movement we've seen in terms of adoption. And that is in large part due to her work. So we're lucky because we have the talent to do that. And I think that goes a long way. But you have to find those special people that have those skills to bring to the table.
Yeah, it's a very design ops driven line of thinking too. It's a layered on top of systems thinking, but how do you systematically up level how team A may be doing things as well as team B, team C, all the way down to team Z like we have. And being able to listen to, we talked about support in a previous episode, being able to parse the support channels and see and try to either use, like you said, use pattern recognition or use personal pattern recognition, just scrolling through support and then seeing if there anything that seems to be a major pain point in the onboarding process. So there may not be enough documentation in the tool, or they may not be able to find the documentation when they first start. So how do we start feeding them smaller nuggets of information to get them started? And one thing that we had tried at Disney was similar to Figma's playground. Like when they do different feature releases, they have a playground file. Cultivating a Disney Plus playground file that has templates and components, and running that in a workshop setting for a 1.5 hour sort of thing, and seeing if people could break it, and seeing where the gaps are. And then over time, that's really helped us in the past really tune what our message is that we need to get out to those product designers during the first month or day 31, like I would like to say.
Absolutely.
Episode 2, Design Technologists.
Yeah, how would you say is your split between working with design system practitioners in your team versus feature product designers at Pinterest?
Yeah, I think it's probably close to like a 60-40 split. So 60% of my time working with my direct design systems team and 40% of my time working with the other feature designers at Pinterest. A lot of that is through things like office hours and Slack channels. And, you know, with everyone remote, we rely on Slack a lot to get the everyday conversations done. And so anytime we're making updates to components or designers are coming up to us in office hours asking for requests, we work really closely with them to make sure that, you know, whatever we have planned or whatever we haven't accounted for is meeting the needs of the designers that we support, because at the end of the day, that's what our design systems team is. In our onboarding session, we talk about how our gestalt team is not just a design system. It's really a service. Our whole team is working to help all of our designers and engineers at Pinterest to do their job better or more efficiently, easier, whatever it is that they need help with. Our goal is always to support that.
I think this is a question for both of y'all. So you mentioned, I think, the word prototyping, and I think from the Disney streaming side, we did have a small UI development team that sort of started from the prototyping and with the idea of prototyping being more, I would say, from the Disney streaming side, it's very sizzle reel. It's very presentation. It is not necessarily, from product designer's point of view, you can't see this, but steeped in reality is my quotations. So how have you shaken that notion of being a UI developer that worked on prototypes versus a a design technologist that works on day-to-day real life production?
I think, at least from my end, a lot of it is interacting with people on a daily basis and really being there as soon as they have a question. So they know that, like you said, we're not doing these kind of nice to have prototypes that get thrown away a few weeks later after the demo is done, which is definitely how I started. But since then, I've definitely transitioned into much more day-to-day support for our designers and our engineers, constantly working with them on Slack and answering any questions that come up. And encouraging them to do prototypes or helping them with prototypes that are built using the design system. So they're not seen as throwaway code. They're seen as like, you know, a work in progress or a MVP that can be built upon and is not a waste of time. And I think anytime we can prove that the benefits of having those prototypes that we can send to research or we can test internally with multiple people and then be able to say, okay, well, here, engineers, like this is, you know, 20% done to start with, and you can just build off of it, I think is always really powerful.
Episode 3, releases and versioning.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head, at least even saying the word changelog, which may scare us designers. And we don't think that it's necessarily just, you know, doing the paperwork and then documenting our work because we need to record the outputs, but it's really trying to understand when specific changes were made. And we think a lot about our component libraries, specifically talking towards our Disney Plus component libraries that are in Sketch being used and maintained for 2 years. So we did a really good job as a federated design system team for a long time managing these on our own. We do our work and we didn't have a release schedule. It was continuous, like you said. So as we intake work, if you need this out tomorrow, we'll get it out to you, you know, by tomorrow. And what that really did at the time was it allowed you to ingest components very quickly. We had a very good adoption of updating component libraries. Now, as you scale, that may not be the case. We found as we've scaled and worked with more designers, designers may be hesitant to take in component library updates due to breaking changes. In Figma specifically, I think there is a little bit of a hesitancy towards taking in updates due to prototyping and prototypes breaking. So that is one that we've seen as an issue. We've asked designers in the past in terms of the change log, as a feature designer, let's just document from a feature design perspective as you go through the discovery phase and you take your stuff up however far you go, whether it's through your manager, your director, what are different design decisions that you've made? Why have you made them? And what may be the downstream impact? And I think that getting something like that adopted has been extremely, extremely powerful. Very new. We've only piloted that idea with one team. But I think that that's something that would power a changelog pretty, pretty well. Episode 5, Figma is not a design system. What if we go back in time to our previous episode where we talked about Figma as a source of truth and play devil's advocate and say, but PJ, we just talked about that Figma is our source of truth.
Yeah. So funny you mention that. Like of all the sources of truth, and this is this is going to be a fun one.
Sources of truth or alternate sources of truth.
Yeah. Yeah. My personal opinion is that the design file is, if I had to choose a thing to be the source of truth, which we're obviously aiming for, it would not be the design file. It would be the thing that the folks using the product are engaging with. I mean, and that's not a hot take, right? Like I think a lot of people have said production code is the source of truth. The thing that I think drives a lot of us nuts is the fact that we have to try to keep these two things in sync. Ideally, we'd live in a world where our design files could ingest production code and translate it into vector assets that we could drag on a blank canvas. You know, Framer X has been playing with that. It's been something that I think a lot of folks have been wanting for some time. Until then, we're doing our best to create a single source of truth by keeping a bunch of things up to date manually. But it's not optimal by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I've been waiting probably for 3 years since we've last worked together to bring this up somewhere publicly. And I think there's sort of two extremes, I think, to this thinking. And I think when we talked about this 3 years ago, I was probably so clouded on the idea of keeping files as the system and the representation of designer artifacts as the end goal. And there's, I would say, PJ-isms. And I think PJ-isms, I'm waiting for you to spit out your coffee. I see PJ drinking his coffee right now. Let's spit out that $6 cup of Phil's coffee. I would say the idea that I perceive that we should move further away from code and strict design artifacts. And I think apps like Webflow are getting us there. And there's no code movement going on. That's the PJ-isms. And then I would say then there's like the DSS-isms, the Disney streaming-isms, where we need design artifacts for everything. We need Figma screens and Figma frames for every single screen and every single state that needs to be produced. And I think 3 years ago, I was led to believe that that was the way. But I don't feel that way anymore. And I also don't believe that the source of truth solely lives in Figma or Sketch or XD. I think a template of that may live there. I think an expression of that lives there, but we need to do better at bringing in what is live in reality and injecting that into our tools to make sure that we have a better accurate representation. And as you said, like we at Disney Streaming support 137 platforms today, possibly more. So the organizationally, the coded components and a coded, doc site representing each platform team may not be the right case for us. It may not even be the representation that we could bring into Figma, because then we would have possibly four different representation of how TV design screens are built based on what language Xbox would maybe using versus tvOS. So that may not work for us. But the fear is that we do a lot of this design system management and we do a lot of this component building in isolation in the tool. We do a lot of optimizations. And one thing that I wanted to sort of note is we are one of the, you know, hundreds of teams, I'm sure in the land that are, have transitioned from Sketch to Figma. When we were rebuilding our components, we wanted to make sure not that the numbers in the auto layout were perfect and mapped to where we wanted it to be. We needed to map to what was the accurate representation of what engineering had built. So some of the numbers may not have looked pretty. But we're by no means should be building something that is cleaned up, that is not then sort of taken back to engineering. We have to have as accurate of a representation as possible. So if something had something that didn't fall under 4 pixel spacers, for instance, we needed to represent what it looked like and then file a ticket to then possibly, you know, make a change to improve. Yeah. So there's lots of things that we've seen that are done in isolation in Figma. And some designers don't have the awareness that there's downstream impact going to code. And there then becomes a Figma source of truth and a live app source of truth.
Yeah. So this is just my opinion, obviously, but I personally do believe that design files are a means to an end. And honestly, if I could forego it and just write out a sentence of, hey, this is how the experience works, whatever it takes to get there as quickly as possible with the highest degree of accuracy, that typically is a design file, but that's just, I wonder how much of that is just due to how we've done the work. But the challenge with design files is, at least the way I've worked for God knows feels like the bazillion years. You put this design together and then it hits code and it immediately changes, right? There's tweaks like, oh crap, we didn't think about this. And that idea is evolving very quickly outside of the design file, which means it's immediately out of date. And the cost associated with keeping it up to date is typically doesn't make sense. And its value falls off a cliff as soon as that feature ships, especially since it's typically not a one-to-one reality of what's currently in production. So what I've seen for myself is that those design files are pretty disposable after the point of articulating what you're trying to put on a screen. And therefore, because of that, why invest a ton of time in a disposable artifact as opposed to trying to invest your time in making the thing that does have, you know, consistent long-term value, which is production code. That's the thing that you're waking up at 3 a.m. to try to fix because of an outage. That's the thing that really is bringing in the money. How can you invest more time in that as opposed to an artifact that, you know, falls off a cliff in terms of value?
Episode 6, mandates. You'll find PJ's blog post about it. And I think one thing that we don't talk as much about in terms of design systems, and I think mandates was part of this piece, but the community and the communication aspect of this. So I wanted to dig into how do you, for lack of a better term, how do you enable and enforce mandates across design and engineering?
At Pinterest, what we're trying to do is just is not mandate usage, but just start to develop a relationship where once we are a little bit more mature, we'd like this to be the starting point. And if it ain't working, great. How is it not working? it's not a matter of whether you use it or not. It's more of, hey, if you're not using it, what is causing that so we can improve? But without that feedback, if we're just ignored, if we're just out of the loop, in the product development process, we're never going to improve. So if we can be a part of that group and get that constant feedback, we'll get there eventually. And we'll be able to improve the system to the point where we don't need mandates for usage, because it's just the ideal solution for engineers and designers. So that's the way I've been personally looking at it, less about, hey, you need to use this, and more about, hey, let's just work together, and tell us how it's not working so we can make it useful in the future.
Yeah, I've been thinking about how you might ask me this question for a few days now, and we're in an interesting spot from a maturity level where we've built in some pretty good alignment on usage of the system. So all of the Disney streaming designers that have worked on Disney Plus have a pretty good understanding that this is where you start. And this is, ironically, this is where you end as well. This is like, we are a unique team that helps facilitate design delivery as well. So in the best interest of engineering, they're looking for mandates on adherence to the design language. I think it becomes much more loose and ambiguous when it becomes net new components versus templates. They're looking at a very foundational level that they need to make sure that we adhere to the design language that, you know, we've been working on, and that has been vetted and lives in code. So that's the lowest common denominator for them. And then they sort of go down the line just to ensure that we've been involved as a design system team. And one term that I'm also very a little dodgy on is the word tollgate.
Tollgate. I haven't heard that term before.
Yeah, because it could be perceived in a very poor fashion. So I would imagine a branch review or code review is a tollgate.
Got it. Yeah.
Back to like our branching episode, there would never be a world where you could branch code and just merge it without code review. That's not realistic, right? And we should treat the system in that fashion as well. We should treat it with the same integrity and the same respect. So everything in the design language and everything in the system that lives there today has been, you know, like the Sierra Nevada logo, it's been argued upon for many, many years.
The Sierra Nevada logo has been argued upon?
If you look on the cans of, I don't have one in front of me, but if you look at a can of Sierra Nevada, like their slogan is it's been argued upon for many years, like this. Let me look it up here.
I had no idea. I'm learning so much.
Family owned, operated, and argued over. So there we go. Yeah, like these decisions that we make are not trivial in the design system, and we've taken them to hell and back. We've taken them to product. We've been rejected. We've taken them to design. They've been rejected. We've redone stuff nth number of times. We've taken them into engineering. We've got the stuff built, and then by that time we got to redo it all again. But episode 7, Jira Mormont. We plan more of on the epic level. We usually typically allow our product teams to plan at that initiative level. So I wanted to understand from you, PJ, knowing that you do your planning in halves, how what is the level of granularity of your planning? Like when you sort of do that exercise, are you planning out specific story types that you stub out? How does that look for you?
That's a good question. It starts off pretty broad and vague. And then at some point you got to gut check it. You know, we said we were going to do this thing. Can we actually do it? And so at some point it does have to start getting broken down into something resembling scope and level of effort. Typically takes its shape as placeholder stories, epics, you know, the typical artifacts of Jira. And honestly, it can exist in, you know, like a paper doc or a coded doc early on, if that allows you to get faster. You know, you know, creating tickets in Jira isn't necessarily the fastest process in the world. So it's really just trying to get the idea out as quickly as possible and then codifying it in a more centralized location down the road.
You mentioned using Google Sheets as well. Like, is there a compelling reason to have a little bit of a split off of the documentation, like when you're like in this sort of discovery phase?
If it helps you get to an answer faster, then I'm all for it. I think the risk that I've seen is that you do it and then you don't call that branch on the tree. That's, you know, whatever metaphor you want to use, and people are still referring to that, and it causes fragmentation and confusion and that's the risk. And I am absolutely guilty of that, where great, we finished it. Awesome. On to the next thing. And you just move on and you forget to close that loop. And then all of a sudden folks are still going there. They're referring to that. They're confused. Why is, you know, it says this, why are you doing that? And that is no longer the source of truth, which goes back to the whole central, like the theme of single source of truth. So I think that's the big takeaway, is if, you know, do whatever you need to do to be as fast as possible. But once that thing is no longer the thing, get rid of it, burn it, throw it away, whatever you need to do to make sure that folks aren't referring to it.
I am myself guilty. So AKA Davey PM, because I've been the program manager for the team for a little bit. I'm also known as JRR Tokens per our last episode.
Well done.
Got to sneak that in there. I've been guilty myself of using Google Sheets just as like a tertiary tracker. And this is just due to, as much as we like to think designers love Jira and design leaders love Jira, we found they do
sorry,
not.
Wait, what? Designers do not. Yeah. I don't know what universe you've been living in, but I have not met a single designer that, you know, wakes up and says, you know what I love? I love Jira. So that's interesting, because I haven't had that similar experience.
Design leaders also do not love Jira. And I think they're looking for better, for worse. I think they're looking for more succinct documentation, in the sense of, even if we are tracking planning of design system output for this next half, they might just want to see progress like in a Google Sheet. That's something that they're more familiar with. So we've run into that issue ourselves, and I've utilized Google Sheets in a very manual fashion, where I use that to list all of the things that we're going to be building in this quarter, from most atomic, like type ramp, color ramp, to all of the subatomic and then components, and then also templates. But then, like you said, as we finish the initiative, that spreadsheet it doesn't really have any more value other than just like as a capture of this in time. So I do think that it's important to try to utilize the tool that is the, you know, product definition source of truth, which in this case is Jira. I've also had great interest in learning other facets of this, like structure or other more advanced capabilities. But then I also think to myself that my job is only partially as like the program manager. Like I don't want to necessarily dive in and develop one way of working in structure that may not be, you know, supported by a program manager when they come along.
Yeah, it's a challenge, because you have different functions that work in different ways, and the more differently they work, the higher likelihood that there's going to be communicational challenges, workflow challenges, just general compatibility issues. And so half of the rationale is just, you know, hey, if engineering is on Jira, unless it's crushing our souls to a point where we absolutely can't do our work, I think there's a strong case to stay there, because ultimately, if we're not aligned with engineering, the stuff we design don't get shipped. And that's kind of the point. So that's been a large case for it as well, to really try to meet engineers where they're at, and give them the best shot to succeed. So design ultimately succeeds as well, but it's not always, you know, the most enjoyable experience in the world.